On behalf of the LSE European Institute and Flemings, gives me great pleasure to welcome Hans-Olaf Henkel here tonight to the LSE. Hans-Olaf Henkel was born in Hamburg. After completing a commercial apprenticeship, he studied at the University for Economics and Politics in Hamburg. In 1962, he joined the manufacturing division of IBM Germany, where he embarked on a two-year training program. From 1964 onwards, he held various executive positions at IBM in the US, in East Asia, Germany, and the European headquarters in Paris. In 1982, Mr. Henkel became Vice President of IBM Europe. In 1983, he was appointed President of the Areas Division, with responsibility for all European, African, and Middle East countries, with the exception of a small cluster of European states. In 1985, he was appointed Vice President, and in January 1987, President of IBM Germany. In October 1993, he was appointed President of IBM World Trade Europe Middle East Africa Corporation. From January 1995 to April 1997, Mr. Henkel was Chairman, is now a member of the Supervisory Board of IBM Deutschland. He's also a member of a whole variety of other major company boards in Germany and elsewhere. He's a member, too, of some of the most prominent institutions to do with the promotion of scientific research in Germany. In 1992, Mr. Henkel received an honorary degree from the Technical University of Dresden and was declared Ecological Manager of the Year by the World Wildlife Fund. On the 28th of November 1994, Hans-Olaf Henkel was elected President of the Federation of German Industries for a two-year term, beginning 1st of January 1995. On 25th of November 1996, he was elected for another two-year term. The title of his talk tonight is What Can Germany and Britain Learn from Each Other? A good deal, I suspect, and I'm very happy to welcome him here tonight.
Professor Giddens, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. It is an honor and a pleasure and an opportunity to speak to you today. An honor because considering the worldwide reputation the school has, we Germans are very proud of our own educational system, although it needs to be revamped. And as you probably know, we have had a major student demonstration today all over the country. But still, I think we have a good educational system, but we don't have a London School of Economics. And this institution is also very well known in my country. And I remember very well, it was at the time the Beatles were in Hamburg. I studied in Hamburg when Ralf Dahndorf, who was then the youngest German professor, was also my professor in sociology. And I remember him so well when he sort of came by with his white VW convertible, always open. He drove to the university, and I was always thinking, what a great man, 10 years older than I. And if somebody would have told me that he later would have been in your position, the one you have now, and would have started an own career in this country, ending up in the House of Lords. He was also in the St. Anthony's College and so on. I would have declared anybody who would have predicted this nuts. But nevertheless, talking to you also presents to me a formidable challenge, because I know that an incredible of personality, a lot of personalities have been talking here to you. And also, I think, is David Marsh here or is he not here? He's not here. Liar. He said he would be here. Well, okay, when he's coming, then we will do something special, okay? Clap in the hands. Anyway, it is a challenge, because I thought we had David Marsh here, and he is, of course, a formidable expert on Anglo-German relations. Second last time I saw him was when I had dinner with the Chancellor, Prince Philip and a few other people in Hanover, and we were sitting around a round table and had a nice discussion, and David Marsh came and interrupted the Chancellor eating, and there's nothing worse you can do, and spoiled his appetite with his usual criticism of the European currency, but nevertheless. So he's not here, then I'm more relaxed. So, and it is a good opportunity because I think it is the first time I publicly speak. No, it's the second time. But anyway, I haven't done this then, so I can do it now. It's the second time I publicly speak in this country. And I would like to thank you also here on behalf of German industry for helping us reconstruct Germany after the Second World War, and of course helping us in our with your investments in reconstructing Eastern Germany, because it's quite a mess we found there. And secondly, to talk about the subject, what can we learn from each other? I think this is an important subject, perhaps more important to us than to you, but certainly to both of us when we get to the subject of Europe, because both of us, I think, should influence the shape Europe is taking, and not only Germany and France. In covering the subject, I have felt I should respond to three questions. You can later ask me, of course, the questions you have in mind, but I picked out three questions, not only because those are easy ones to answer, but because I really believe they are important. Number one, very short one, how do we relate to each other? The second one is, what are our relative strengths and weaknesses? And finally, what can we both do for the future of Europe? Well, if you ask me to summarize my little speech here in three sentences, I would say, first, we depend on each other. Second, we need each other. And thirdly, Europe would be well advised to learn from the good decisions and from the mistakes both of us made. First, how do we relate to each other? Well, Britain is, after France, our second most important customer. And that is, of course, very important to the president of the German industry. So I must be nice to you. Buy German. We were just visiting one of those places. What was that called, this place? Where we bought... Well, yeah, I will say this. I know this is not popular here. But what was this place called? No, where we bought this, the little shop, the little... Yes. Yes. So what did we buy? We bought a Christstollen, made in Germany. Anyway, so... But I do remember that, and in fact, we don't have any buy German kind of things in my country, but I do remember 20 years ago you had one here, by British. This was a very funny campaign. We interpreted it in this way, by British companies. but I don't know whether that's what you meant. Anyway, and Germany is, together with the United States, your largest, second largest customer. So, and while the balance of trade between our two countries is still somewhat in our favor, if you look at the investments, it's totally different. And since 1993, Britain is indeed the favorite country for German investments abroad. In the last 2 years alone, German companies invested more than 15 billion Deutschmarks in Britain. And if you look at British investments in Germany for the same period, the picture is rather poor. In 1995, you just invested 2.1 billion Deutschmarks in Germany. And in 1996, you took more capital out of Germany than you put in. In fact, we were the only country in the world which had a disinvestment in 1996. So as you well know yourself, Great Britain is not only attractive for German investors, almost one-third of all foreign investment in the European Union is landing here. Between 1990 and 1995, you received a total of 220 billion marks, six times as much as Germany, from foreign investors. So for you, I think this is a rather eloquent proof that Britain has overtaken Germany as the most dynamic economy in Europe. For us, it is a most alarming signal. Have we forgotten, I talk about us, not about you, have we forgotten that the rules of competition between companies follow the same as those between societies? Which means that if your partner on this particular case, even competitor, moves faster than you, even if you move faster than you used to, you can fall behind. And I do remember well when Helmut Schmidt regularly lectured Margaret Thatcher on the basics of economical facts and theories. You were then all too young, of course, but I do remember it didn't make us much popular in this country. But in Germany today, many businessmen, including myself, economists, and also an increasing number of politicians, point to Britain when looking for a model of successful change. In April this year, we celebrated in Hanover the 50th anniversary of the Hanover Fair. As I said earlier, the Duke of Edinburgh, Helmut Kohl, was there, and also the Prime Minister of the state of Lower Saxony, one of the two possible candidates for Chancellor to be nominated by the Social Democratic Party. I mean, of course, Gerhard Schröder. And the official partner country was Great Britain, because it was the generosity of a British general who in 1947 suggested to us Germans that we should have a fair in Hanover displaying our rather modest product line at that time to the rest of the world. And meanwhile, you know what has become of German industry. And the Hanover Fair is the largest industrial fair in the world. So again, British generosity was in the beginning. But I took the opportunity to compare the both societies publicly. A risky enterprise, as I found out later. The Chancellor wouldn't talk to me for a while because wide circles in my society still regard the Anglo-Saxon example as something you shouldn't use. It's politically still not correct to say that what Margaret Thatcher did finally turned out to be successful and was probably very necessary. I always say in Germany, let's follow the, accelerate reforms in Germany so we don't have to do what Margaret Thatcher had to do. So it's very useful. And it is, of course, much less risky to tell the British what they can learn from us, I suspect, even here. And this gets me to the second question, what can we then really learn from each other? Well, obviously, the situation in our countries are, these situations are much different. Our historical, political, and economical developments are different. But I think the concept of benchmarking, that means comparison of not only countries, companies or products, but also countries and societies, is an important tool not only for companies, but also for those people responsible for whole societies. So let me first say what I think we can learn from Britain. A year ago, I invited the then opposition leader, Tony Blair, to address the annual conference of the BDI, which is the equivalent of the CBI here, to speak to our annual convention, as I said, and it was just 2 weeks before the elections in Britain. And of course, I had an agenda. He used the opportunity to impress the British press, which traveled with him, and they reported back that 1,400 leading businessmen in Germany really liked what he said. This helped him. I liked the idea of telling the German Social Democrats that there is a speech which you cannot differentiate from a speech which I had been given in terms of the substance, of course not in terms of the eloquent delivery. But and my hidden agenda was to impress the German Social Democrats that there is a Labour leader who has gotten the message. By the way, also I tried to impress the conservative liberal government in Germany because the speech he gave I haven't heard by a member of our own government, conservative liberal government, in terms of, modernness and the fact that you must support business if you want to create jobs. So Today, Tony Blair's policies are considered a benchmark, and not only for our social democratic opposition, which are far behind him, but also our own conservative liberal government. And clearly, a deregulated economy, a tax system conducive to growth, flexible labor markets, swift privatization of public entities are conditions we need in Germany too. And the British recipe is as simple as it is successful. Leaner government leads to lower cost and lower taxes. Privatization leads to better services and lower charges. Liberalization to more competition and less bureaucracy, and greater individual responsibility to relief in the burden of social cost. A combination of all this, and that is the message of the British experience, and by the way, also of the experience of some other societies like New Zealand or the United States, to a certain extent even Netherlands or the Nordic countries in Europe. The message is that this will all bring more growth and more employment. At present, you are discussing the introduction of a minimum wage in the range of £3 to £4 British pounds. Compare this with collectively agreed tariff wages of almost six British pounds in the German metal industry. And I took the opportunity when I met Mr. Mendelssohn this morning and Margaret Beckett this afternoon to tell them that we can learn, of course, from each other a lot, but we can also learn from the mistakes we made. And our minimum wage was a clear mistake. It has cost us hundreds and thousands of jobs in Germany and is one of the major reasons why we have such high unemployment. So my message to these two ministers or secretaries were that they should be very careful when honoring the promise they made. They, of course, feel obliged to make to meet the promise, but there's still the question of how high should the minimum wage be. So, and the other thing is very interesting. The reforms in Britain were not only good for those people looking for jobs. They are also good for the people having jobs. The hourly labor costs in Britain are about half as much as in Germany. But the purchasing power is about the same. So I think it is time to see and discuss what Germany can bring to Britain. What could you learn from us? Well, our unemployment rate for the young people is still considerably lower than yours. And many people believe that the skilled worker in Germany is better qualified as compared to yours. I will state it this way because this is what has been reported. Otherwise, it sounds a little too arrogant, but many people say that. And it is surprising to me that the practice of vocational training is practically non-existent in Britain. Our transportation system, from railroad to autobahn, is something we are proud of. Our environmental management is something I think Britain should look at. Take our own initiative to meet the challenges of global warming. I signed with the government an agreement 3 years ago for a voluntary reduction of the specific CO2 emissions by 20% between 1990 and the year 2005. And the government appointed an independent body to supervise the promise I made. And last week, in the presence of three German ministers, we published the report for the first time, and I could confirm to the public that we met our commitment. So in terms of environmental policies, I think the government can learn something from Germany. We still invest more in research and development than you do, both in the private sector and by the state, even though then in some sectors like biotechnology, etc., we have been very slow and are now catching up, and we have been slow because of, I think, enormous opposition by some members of the Green Society who believe that biotechnology is something bad, but also here I think we have made progress. And finally, our social stability and solidarity have been for decades a competitive advantage of Germany. I remember very well when you had here massive strikes and the strike days lost per 1,000 work days in Britain were about 10, 20 times as much as in Germany. But I must admit that Britain has caught up here. And again, when many people in Germany say that this consensus system, which has reduced or kept strikes and social unrest at a lower level, has been successful, they seem to forget that the others have changed also. And there's only one or two countries in Europe which have generally strike problems. One is Spain, and the other one is France. And if you look at the French problem, it is primarily the transportation sector and the public sector. So, and also currently it seems that Germany's economy is back on a modest growth track, but I must tell you there's little evidence that this will have really an impact on the labor market. Unemployment, particularly in East Germany, remains very high. It's 11% for the country, it's 18% in East Germany. And that's a crazy, unacceptable figure. And when I told the Chancellor about 2 years ago that since a few weeks, once I found out, the unemployment rate in Britain is now lower than ours, he first didn't want to believe it. Because for decades we have been used to a Britain which has high unemployment rates, high inflation, low productivity. So it all has changed. But still you may say, why can you have a problem? Aren't you year after year the most successful country in terms of exports? Don't you still have one of the highest standards of living? In the European Union? Well, this, of course, is still true, but the trouble is that while we are still proud of some of these records, we are not as quickly adjusting as we should. Today we have more unemployed than during the early 30s, if you know what I mean by that. And of course you shouldn't be worried. We don't have them roving in the streets and so on. They are well taken care of, maybe too well, and maybe that's one of the reasons for the high level of unemployment in Germany. Well, what happened to us, you may ask? I think the causes are complex. My explanations for these developments will be very simple. Of course, globalization has hit us, as it has hit you. But for most German companies, globalization is nothing new. We are investing and exporting into all corners of the world since decades. But for the politicians responsible for the Deutschland AG, I think it is indeed new that others are not only as willing as we are to export, but also as capable. And then the second reason, reunification. Now, overall, this was a good thing for us and successful. But let's face it, we let our eyes get off the ball for a while. We concentrated, of course, on the reconstruction of East Germany and didn't show up in Korea or in South America. And we also helped in the peaceful transition of the economies in Eastern and Central Europe. And let's not forget, we invested an enormous amount of money there. Much of it is sunk, not only because these are new markets for German industry. And by the way, the markets aren't as promising as we thought. But we made a contribution to world peace, I guess, because the peaceful transition of that part of the world, if you take the unfortunate case of ex-Yugoslavia out, in part is also due to our engagement in Eastern Europe. So also you benefit from it, if I may say. And the economic challenge of unification continues to be a real monumental problem. 40% of the entire GNP of East Germany is coming from West Germany. In total, that's 5% of Germany's GNP. Much has been achieved, on the other hand. We have created more than 500,000 companies and more than 3.5 million jobs, but we have lost more jobs. Before the war came down, the industry in East Germany had 3.3 million employees. Today it has 580,000. That tells you something about the efficiency behind the Iron Curtain. So we need to recover and reconstruct the eastern part of our country, and it takes much more time than we thought, including myself. And by the way, foreign investors, including British ones, have helped us and have taken advantage of the opportunities in the new lender. And meanwhile, East Germany has indeed developed some advantages over West Germany and over some European countries. The old collective regime of central wage negotiations has all but collapsed. Unions lost 50% of their membership between 1991 and 96 in East Germany. And local authorities in the East are much more flexible than in the West. And reunited Germany in general, well, while many Germans know that there is no alternative to globalization, few people yet understand that we do not have the time we take to adjust. We need not only to change a lot, we must change many things at the same time. We have got to get the tax burden on companies under control. Why Gordon Brown yesterday announced a tax rate deduction from 33 to 31% in the year 98 and to 30% in the year 1990. German companies are still taxed 60% when they make a profit and retain it. And we need to cut the government share of our economic activity down. While it is about 41% here, it's over 50% in Germany. We must improve the profitability of German companies. While the average net after tax rate on turnover here is 6%, 6% in the UK and Great Britain, it's 1.8% in Germany. And the British workers pay less taxes. He also pays much less for social security contributions. And since this is, of course, true for the entire country, he spends less of his net pay for many goods and services. And this is one reason why the British worker, why causing double as high hourly work charges, has actually the same amount of purchasing power of his net pay. Now let me come to the third question and last question. What can we both do together for Europe? Many in German industry are encouraged by the recent change, I should say, in the British government, governmental approach to Europe. A constructive attitude towards European integration and an active participation by the EU is in the British interest, but of course also in the interest of Germany. And I mentioned this morning to Mr. Mendelssohn and Mrs. Beckett. We need them. The employment successes achieved by Great Britain, as well as the Netherlands, by the way, and some other European countries like Portugal, with an unemployment rate of only 7%, are setting the benchmarks for the European Union. And it is important that Britain is taking the lead to help establish competitive economic and labor market policy throughout Europe. I was impressed today, both. The word most frequently used by these two ministers was competitiveness, and this from a Labour government. Competitiveness is not as frequently used by any German minister of our current cabinet. And we will not succeed in our fight, in our efforts to fight unemployment, unless we all recognize one basic precondition, which we have achieved here. Profitable and long-term jobs can only be created by companies operating in a market, be they domestic or foreign companies, be they established or be they newcomers. The simple truth was not as clear during the recent employment summit in Luxembourg as it should have been. And had it not been for the British government and the Spanish government, we would have gotten some crazy decisions out of Luxembourg this time. The struggle for the right recipes in Europe to foster competitiveness and employment continues, and I count on the British to take leadership here, and I'm glad that they not only continue with the policies of the previous government, I'm also glad that they try to spread them to the continent. Some ideas, such as legally mandated cuts of weekly working hours, are indeed cause of great concern, like President Jospin, Prime Minister Jospin now has decided, or like Prime Minister Prodi has committed. Britain should not hesitate and offer guidance in Brussels and other European capitals. In Germany, Italy, Belgium, and to a lesser extent still Spain, large proportions of the political elite are still looking for a third way between socialism and capitalism. It is very simple. The longer they take to realize that this is a dead end, the longer it takes for them to create long-lasting new jobs. we must continue to resist these temptations to delegate the solutions of our unemployment problems upwards, for instance, to the level of Brussels. This is a national responsibility, and I just don't understand that Brussels, which has preached this principle of subsidiarity all the time, is now trying to elevate the problem of the solution to unemployment to Brussels. If that doesn't work, the next idea is to let's elevate it to the WTO. While in many ways the focus on Europe is good, we must not lose sight of the fact that European countries are not only competing with each other, but increasingly our continent is challenged on a global scale by Asia, of course. And don't be misled, the problems in Asia today are not a reason to say, well, we have a competitor less. On the contrary, they will be much more aggressive because they have to if their own local markets are not growing as fast as they predicted. They will redouble their efforts to export and compete with us here or elsewhere. So I count on British government to play a major role in establishing that thought as a guiding principle for a competitive Europe. Of course, in the long term, British leadership in Europe will also depend on its position towards the European currency. No question. I'm on one hand very encouraged by the recent announcement that Britain will not only approach the European currency actively and constructively, I'm also a little disappointed that they say not in this particular legislative period. But anyway, we commend the British decision to get involved, and British should help establish a stable and sustainable European currency. Yes, we would like to see Britain to join the European Currency Union much earlier. And this is clearly the position of many German investors also in this country who have said it. And I think some Japanese investors have said it also, as they otherwise will not enjoy the benefits of the EMU here. And British companies will also realize that it is costly not to be part of the EMU very early. After all, the euro is an important complement to the benefits of the single market. Let me be quite honest. The German public is as skeptical as the British public. If you had a referendum today, the Germans would refuse. The German politicians didn't commit to a referendum. And the entire political elite is in favor. And I'm very often blaming and criticizing political leaders for not making unpopular decisions. And you have heard business people all over the world complaining about politicians who only listen to what the public wants and so on and do not take long-term views. Here we have an example of politicians not listening to the public and making a good decision for our children, although it's unpopular. However, I should tell you that the reception of the German public towards the currency union is slowly rising, and that the vast majority anyway believes it's coming. So, and also in German industry, this thing was debated, as it was in the CBI. And we came after quite a long debate and analysis to the conclusion that this is good for German industry. In fact, it's good for European industry. And the main reason is not that we save currency transaction cost and transparency and all this. I mean, if you want to buy a car in Britain, you can easily translate the marks to pounds and know how much Daimler-Benz cost in this country. No, the real, for me, the major advantage is that the convergence criteria, which we are all aspiring to meet, basically describe a very successful economical model. By the way, it's the old German model before we left it. And it's a model which is being practiced by exactly the same countries which were those who created a lot of employment. Who has the criteria in the bag today? The United States, Great Britain, Denmark, New Zealand, Sweden, Netherlands, Portugal. These are countries which created jobs and make the currency criteria. So the idea that, which was forwarded in The Sun last week, was it last week, that the currency union is responsible for the unemployment in Germany is completely absurd. On the contrary, only a disciplined, long-term oriented fiscal, economical, and social policy, which is described by those criteria, can create long-lasting jobs. So we are in favor, and I'm very convinced it is coming on time, by the way. Now, next to the European currency is the enlargement, also very important to British industry, and I really appreciate the support I'm getting from the CBI and the support British government is extending to that idea, because the French are much more reluctant. It's very important to us too. Enlargement is the other big strategic project. Together with Germany, Britain is indeed taking a very leading role in Europe to make it happen. And in the medium term, the EU membership of the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, and of course their integration into Europe, into a European internal market, will benefit the European economy and will strengthen the competitive position of Europe, very much like the United States has embarked into a NAFTA with Mexico and Canada. That made North America an order of magnitude more competitive. So the enlargement of Europe with Eastern Europe will make us much more competitive. The future of Europe lies in its competitiveness. The continent needs Britain more than ever to regain its own competitiveness. And maybe there's also a little you can learn from us in terms of solidarity. But there must be no misunderstanding. To establish and maintain a British level of labor market flexibility everywhere on the continent does not mean a choice between competitiveness on one hand and solidarity of the other. I fully believe that it is a prerequisite for a Europe which is both competitive and one of social justice. I thank you.
We've now got time for a few questions, if anyone would like to ask them. You can ask people at the back of the room to speak up fairly strongly.
Both Germany and Britain are facing pretty many problems with their university systems, and both countries have gone quite different ways. Britain has decided to increase fees for students, and Germany just decided to basically drop a lot of state financing for the university. What would you, as an industrialist who's afterwards in a position to hire
Well, you're quite right. Both systems are in discussions and maybe in a crisis. Can you hear me? Is this on?
Yeah.
So what I advise to Chancellor Kohl, and I have advised already, is that we need competition. We have no competition in Germany. The students don't compete really with each other. Everybody who has made his Abitur, which is now 34% of the population, can go to the university. The professors don't compete with each other. Whether they do a lot and work very hard, which many do, or whether they don't engage much, they all get the same amount of money. The universities don't compete with each other, because the states in which those universities are located don't compete with each other. We have a legal framework, we call that a university law, and that framework is being decided by the various lender. And currently, the speed at which this framework is being reformed is governed by the slowest of our states. So what I suggest is we scrap it, this law, leave it to each state, because we have states who want to do the same thing like Tony Blair wants to do, charge fees. We have states who want to pay their university professors by not only by showing up, but the way they do their job. We have states who want to come up with modern techniques in terms of managing a university, using computers. No German
professor knows, no German professor knows what his budget is in June. Neither does he know how much he spent. So there's an archaic system there. So the answer to the question is, rather than save like hell, let them compete with each other. Let them charge, if they want to, fees for students. By the way, there is no model in the market in Germany for student fee systems which does not allow enough system, enough support for those students who have parents who can't afford it. So, and by the way, it's also, I think it's a social kind of position you can take, because people who study free of charge are exactly the ones who have a higher salary at the end. So why shouldn't they contribute to their own education? This is the advice I would give.
Professor Giddens informed us that a few years ago, the Worldwide Fund for Nature named you the Ecological Manager of the Year. My question for you is, why do you think that was?
Because it was justified.
What is your environmental agenda?
All right. Well, look, at that time I was in charge of IBM Germany, and Germany is, as you well know, an environmentally conscious country, and we did a lot. We are the first company, for instance, to announce that if you sell a PC, we will take it back and would make sure that it is being reassembled, disassembled in such a way that you could practically use every single thing again in the next generation. We motivated our 31,000 employees themselves to be environmentally conscious when using things like paper. We were the first company who refused to take white paper. We took environmentally compatible paper. We supported large national parks. We supported a piece of the northern German coast. We call it Wattenmeer. I don't know what this is in English. Peter, weißt du das? okay. So we had a comprehensive system, which where the entire company, the employees, the management, the products. We try to develop the products with environmental concerns at the time we designed them. So when you do this, you get to different products, because you, at the time you design the products, you already think about what to do when the product is not anymore used. So for all this, this organization gave me this prize. I must, however, make an admission that we have a nature organization. It's called NABU. It's a national national protection of nature organization. And since I became president of the BDI, I looked at all models of the ecology taxes, and I found that they make no sense. In fact, most of them even hurt the environment. So I fought against the introduction of the energy tax in Germany, and this organization presented me last year with an award which I did not like. It was the dinosaur of the year.
Talking of pension reform, do you believe that the English pension fund model is an alternative to the German pay-as-you-go scheme?
Well, let me put it this way. I don't know your model enough, but our pay-as-we-go scheme is going into a dead end, and it will not work for long. You know, already 21% of a worker's wage is being spent for pension recipients. Half of them have to be paid by the employees, the other half by the employers. And I can predict that in not too far off in the future, this is going to raise to 30%. We must change, and we will have to change it in the following way. One is we must put it on three different prongs. One is a state pension, either guaranteed, it's a sort of a minimum pension, guaranteed for everybody, either paid by the taxpayer or accumulated by some capital funds. Second prong will be a pension which is being accumulated by the employee and the employer, put into a separate fund, separately managed, which we don't have in Germany. You have it in this country, you have it in the United States. By the way, that's also an answer to a question which we always ask in Germany, why don't we have risk capital? And the third prong will be a private life insurance. We cannot do the people in Germany cannot depend anymore on this pension. I get increasing reception with this. 2 years ago, I was almost had to get over here and ask for political asylum when I said it. But now more and more people say, I think this is right, we must change the system. The current government is not going to change the system. And a red-green government is not going to change the system either. So only naked problems will change the system. So probably have to wait for 5 or 6 more years. I'm already demanding that both big parties present to their electorate a new system. They refuse. So the answer to your question is yes, I think we can learn something from the Brits, but we cannot ignore our own history. Well, yeah, this is a fundamental question. The social democrats in Germany believe we don't have enough solidarity. I mean, for a Brit, this must be absolute idiotic, but they believe there is an entire lack of solidarity in Germany, and we have injustice, and the rich are too rich, and the poor are too poor, and all this. I have suggested after the speech of Tony Blair at our convention, I used I'm afraid only Germans will understand the joke. We have a saying, reif für die Insel, which means if somebody is really, totally exhausted, we say he's ready for the island. By the island, we don't really mean Britain. We mean a little bit. We mean an island with a palm tree in the middle, and you can rest. So when he finished his speech, I couldn't resist. I got a lot of criticism for this remark, but I said, "Well, look, I think the Social Democrats should listen to the speech, and later conclude that they are ready for the island," which I think is making it quite clear. Let me put it this way: I think Britain can use a little dose of solidarity, but not too much. Huh? we can use a lot of competitiveness here in Britain. And my worry would be that the British government discovers that it is very popular to sprinkle here or there some goodies, and suddenly you are in a situation where you were in the early 70s. I must tell you, and I like you, no misunderstandings, because I don't, I'm afraid of the British press, that are even worse than the German press, I was told, although I think it is hardly possible, but... I have heard today from the CBI, from Colin Marshall, is that they are happy with this government. And so far there is no indication that they destroy competitiveness of Britain. And on the contrary, I have reported to you that I've rarely heard the word competitiveness as often as I did today. So in answer to your question, a little dose of solidarity. Education, I think, is a right agenda. Training the young, I think this is the right agenda, maybe using our system. But don't learn too much from the continent. Get the continent to change, to make us all as competitive as you are. I don't know the British school system, so here I have one practice. If I don't understand a subject, I will not talk about it. But let me tell you what what is the problem now with the German school system? There are regular tests, let's say in mathematics, where international organization check on students. We used to be very good in mathematics. We have fallen, I will not publicly say to which place, because I don't want that to be in the sun. But in Germany we have after the 68 revolution, or whatever you call this here, we have had a lot of teachers who think that equality is more important than Leistung. Performance, thank you.
Competition.
Yes. So we have some Länder, like Bremen, for instance, where, you know, they didn't give the children don't get any more grades for years. You know, they would say, oh, nice child, always participate or doesn't participate too much. So the parents weren't alarmed, and at the end they were in a mess. So we have got to get a competition, well, let me, performance standards back into our schools. We have a possibility to make our Abitur by some odd things. If you are very good in gymnastics, you can be very poor in mathematics. Well, I would say that is not a very good system to get competitive students out of our schools, or pupils in this case. So our president, the president of our republic, gave a major speech 4 weeks ago in Berlin, and highlighting the requirement to get our whole education system back on track. And I think he's right. I hope that is not the reason why the students are now on the streets. But indeed, this is a big problem we have. We don't have elite schools, this I do know. I wish we had some elite schools, to give the rich an opportunity to have even better educated children than the poor, but just for the reason of competition. Yes. Well, the question was, what is the lesson on the minimum wage in Germany? And the lesson is that when it is... first of all, we don't have a legal minimum wage in the country, and not even the Social Democrats, and that means something, advocate one, neither the Greens. But we have a bargaining system between unions and employers, which effectively came to those minimum wages, however, by industry. And let me take the metalworking example. The minimum wage has increased and increased and increased to the extent that certain jobs you cannot afford anymore, because on top of the wages we have the social charges, the high taxes. So we get a lot of black employment, unofficial employment. There are people who say that we have as many unofficial employment as we have unemployed. And, you know, If you are a painter, you sort of must paint for 5 hours in order to afford a 1 hour plumber. And if you are in that situation, who is paying for plumbing or painting? So I can only say that experience has been bad and poor, and is right now, and in fact, the major debate in Germany on that this minimum wage is too high and that it should be lowered or abolished. So this is a point where I think you go into the wrong direction. Yeah, I'm okay.
You briefly mentioned Gordon Brown and his decision on taxes, which he has announced. Compared to Germany, isn't it that in order to also accelerate, enhance the authority of decision-making regarding core policy issues to address taxes, pension reform, and other areas, one also has to look in Germany at constitutional reform. For example, regarding electoral reform, in light of the failed pension and tax reform?
Well, this sounds like a little trap, because I have proposed exactly that. And some German newspapers like the Süddeutsche Zeitung has suggested that Article 20 of the German Constitution should be put in action. The Article 20 of the German Constitution was put in place by the German government some 25 years ago in order to allow someone to shoot a new Hitler if he ever came to power, because all those attempts which were made at his life were illegal. And so the constitution was changed to make it legal in future. So this newspaper said that, well, this is a guy who is apparently an enemy of the constitution, so the... Well, it was difficult, I tell you. For weeks I was hunted down by a lot of German newspapers. And for the first time in my career, and let's not forget, one of my predecessors was killed by terrorists. For the first time in my job, I was worried about my security. I don't rove around with bodyguards and armored limousines. So. But now the debate in Germany has calmed down, and I got a lot of support. Herr Schäuble has said, well, there is some truth to this. Herr von Lambsdorff has said that. And indeed, I think this is something we should look at, because I like our federal system, but it is not really working. And this will bore the British here, but I do believe we ought to look at the way we make political decisions. And by the way, a lot of countries change their constitution all the time. As you rightfully said, Tony Blair was hardly 2 months in office. He had a constitutional group. They made a proposal on Wales and Scotland. The referendum were done, and here we are. And I'm an enemy of the constitution. So yes, we need to do this, and a lot of taboos in our country which we have to get rid of, and this is one.
You provide a very long list of ills for Germany and Germans today. You blame the government, you blame the opposition, you blame the lazy teachers. Now
I didn't.
You blame federalism. It might also be something wrong with German industry. Which people who actually then might have German managers not be as good as they used to be, might they be too inward looking? I would like to know a bit about what you, your organization, and your members could do rather than just pointing the fingers at everybody else.
Well, I tell you, we don't. First of all, I have not blamed the professors. I want to make this very clear. I have blamed the fact that all professors are treated alike. That's what I blame. So I don't want the record straight. No, the BDI is at the forefront of proposing to the government, in fact, to the society, recipes. We do this all the time. We did one when I was member of this group which was advising the chancellor together with the unions, Kanzlerrunde we called it. In early 96, I proposed, the BDI proposed in a major piece of work how to create 2 million additional jobs in Germany. The government took the goal, accepted the goal. They translated it into halving of the unemployment rate, I guess for copyright reasons. But they ran away with the goal, but they didn't take the medicine we prescribed, or not all of it. So we are take the educational system. We have very clear proposals of how to change the educational system and make it better. We regularly propose to the German industrial colleagues what they should do better. Give you an example. We published an anti-corruption guideline which should be implemented in every German company. Not that we have a vast corruptive problem, but we had some incidents. And Germany is not a country where corruption is really a major problem, but I was worried that it could become. So we took here the guideline and the leadership to propose something. Or may I remind you of this CO2 deal I did with the government. If the German industry standard would be applied everywhere in the world as far as CO2 protection, you could overnight reduce the entire global CO2 emissions by 17%. We are here at the forefront. I'm also quite often agreeing that there are some things we must learn or relearn. We used to have in terms of service mentality, the German society at large is behind. And this has also some impact on the behavior of German companies, no question, but they're trying to do better. So, look, I worked myself for 17 years I don't know how often I moved, but three times in France and twice in the United States and twice in Asia. And I think I really have a good feel for the capability of German management as compared to others, and I hope you don't take it too arrogant. But since I have been rather critical on before, I think you probably, or you could believe me, I think on balance the German managers are probably better than most others. They are not as bureaucratic as the French. I think they deal and motivate their people better than the British. I think they are more long-term oriented than the Americans. And since we have such a problem to be effective in Germany and are still very good, we are number two in exports in the world, don't forget it. I think we are pretty much doing a good job. I don't think there is necessarily a deficit with German management. It is widely sort of claimed by unions, social democrats, and so on. But the very fact that we are very successful when we are abroad means actually that if we are not successful in Germany, it can't be the German industry. But some things like the ones I mentioned, yes, we can do better.
There's just time for one more question. We'll take another one from up there.
Yep. I want to go back to the question of social justice. Your speech was more sort of in favor of Thatcherism, and a byproduct of Thatcherism is sort of if you go to the east end of London, see living a lot of poor people there, or £40 in need of social benefits. Would you like to see such areas in Germany?
No. No, I'm glad that you asked the question so I can perhaps correct the impression. By the way, I don't know what's going to happen if we have 5 million unemployed or 7. But apart from this, when I wake up at night sometimes, and which I do frequently, and say to myself, what will happen to this country, to my country, or to Europe as a continent? I always see sort of two scenarios. One is everything has to get worse, and only then the decisions, which this person here, this gentleman rightfully said, we make very late, only then we make them. So a sort of Margaret Thatcher comes and sets things in order at the expense of exactly the things she had to do here. This is one scenario. The second scenario is, let me say, Netherlands, a country which early recognized they get into trouble and started reforms in 1982. Takes a long time, like the Margaret Thatcher reforms took a long time. And I'm working from morning to evening every day for the second scenario. But in order to get an acceptance for the reforms, I must have the guts to describe the first scenario. And that is what I'm always doing. But I'm in favor of the second one. Thank you.
Well, I think if we did have a competition for a number of people who wanted to ask questions after a lecture, this lecture would stand up very well. So we're very grateful to you for coming. Thanks very much indeed. And thanks for standing up to an ordeal of intense questioning from the audience. Thanks very much.